air that moves with its wheels is totally different from humanoid robots, but it can certainly challenge them and beat them in a football match.
We have taken part in the Maze League of the RoboCup games. It's the first time I'm involved in this big competition, where I have to implement all my programming, mechanics and electronics skills to win the game. I am so excited.
Organizers say RoboCup seeks to promote robotics and artificial intelligence by offering IT experts a real-time challenge to build the most capable robots.
The idea of RoboCup competitions is to increase the creativity of IT experts in developing efficient robots. Why soccer? Because first of all, it is a highly popular sport, and second, it is a highly strategic game that requires a robot to perform many difficult tasks, which, if accomplished, can turn them into strong and capable robots.
RoboCup Iran Open is part of the international initiative dubbed Robot Soccer World Cup, or shortly, RoboCup. The event was first launched in 1997 and was inspired by the victory of a computer chess player against the then world chess champion, Garry Kasparov. The official goal of the competition, as stated by its organizers, is to hone the capabilities of humanoid robot soccer players so that they will win a soccer game against the winner of the most recent FIFA World Cup in mid-21st century.
While robots still have a long way to go before they can challenge the likes of Messi and Ronaldo, the ultimate goal of RoboCup is not about robot footballers beating human rivals, but the technology advances that can be made along the way to improve our lives. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
As the West implements draconian sanctions against Russia, including the banning of the Russian news outlets RT and Sputnik from YouTube, Facebook, Twitter, and TikTok, as well as search engine results, social media censorship of political messaging about the Palestinian liberation struggle continues. Stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Omar Zahza Ryder. This article is published under the heading, Social Media Giants Repress Palestinian Content. Here's the story. Silicon Valley is solidly entrenching itself as a devoted enemy of political dissent. As the West implements draconian sanctions against Russia, including the banning of the Russian news outlets RT and Sputnik from YouTube, Facebook, Twitter, and TikTok, as well as search engine results, social media censorship of political messaging about the Palestinian liberation struggle continues. On March 8, Instagram, owned by Facebook's Meta Platforms, deleted the main account of the organization Within Our Lifetime, or WOL, a New York City-based Palestinian community organization. The social media account was removed over a post that highlighted revolutionary Palestinian women in commemoration of International Women's Day. WOL explained that their account was suspended after years of online censorship and shadow banning. Shadow banning is the practice of restricting social media content that is not noticeable to the user. While companies like Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube once styled themselves protectors of free speech given the highly publicized use of their platforms, their actions over the following years have proved otherwise. As the Electronic Frontier Foundation noted in 2020, rampant censorship on social media is targeted against the very same regions these platforms initially used to promote their ostensible values of free speech. When pressed in the past, social media companies provided vague responses that only focused on technical issues and did not adequately explain the high rate and diverse types of censorship documented by rights advocates, according to the Palestinian digital rights group Hamle. The targeting of WOL's Instagram account shows that we need to whitewash our history as an organization in order to survive on social media. These actions show there is a limit to how much history, culture, and politics you're allowed to express, WOL chair Nardin Keswani told the Electronic Entawasa. Keswani explained that the post initially received a disciplinary action called a strike from Instagram, which she said was common. Historically, she explained, Instagram would strike WOL post with no clear pattern. The company even flagged a January post about a Palestinian prisoner, Hesham Abu Hawash, being infected with COVID-19 while in the Zionist regime hospital. Why should we assume that a post about a Palestinian prisoner getting COVID is going to get a strike? Keswani said. Keswani explained that the Women's Day post not only received a strike, but Instagram also sent a warning that the entire WOL account could be deleted permanently. Following this warning, WOL organizers found themselves unable to access the account. They launched a social media campaign to pressure Instagram to restore the account and on March 12th received an email from Instagram saying only that the account had been disabled by mistake and it would be restored. WOL stated, while the restoration of our main account following a massive outpouring of support from our comrades and supporters around the world marks a victory, we know that Instagram continues to uphold anti-Palestinian racism and actively works directly with our oppressors to silence us. But activists noted that Instagram's lack of transparency and seemingly arbitrary punitive measures indicate that the platform remains an embattled site for liberation-focused political messaging about Palestine. A member of the grassroots organization Palestinian Youth Movement, who asked to remain anonymous, told the Electronic Entefada that the group has had its social media activity heavily challenged since at least 2018, when Facebook began disappearing their posts about protest for the 70th anniversary of the Nakba. The PYM member explained, we wouldn't have the option to invite people to the protest, and we continued receiving messages saying that our page was not being recommended to people. The digital repression escalated in May 2021, when PYM began working with the Yemeni Liberation Movement on actions including a hunger strike opposing U.S. support for the Saudi-led blockade against the Yemeni people. The PYM member mentioned that after the collaboration with the Yemeni movement, their social media began to experience heavy shadow banning, to the point that PYM organizers would have to manually instruct followers to seek out their group's posts, which were not visible to them otherwise. While one can only speculate about the precise reasons for such restrictions, Instagram itself has admitted to limiting the visibility of the content it deems inappropriate even when the posts in question don't run afoul of the platform's community guidelines. Laura L. Borno is a Palestinian-American lawyer and podcast host who uses social media to call attention to the Palestinian liberation struggle. She told the Electronic Intifada that her personal Instagram account swelled to more than 40,000 followers after the world's attention turned to the Zionist regime's planned expulsions of Palestinian families in Sheikh Jarrah and the Zionist regime's attacks on Gaza in May 2021. She said, "But with more followers came increased repression. Several of my posts would be deleted by Instagram for alleged hate speech or violence." She says that some of the deleted posts included images of Zionists calling for a second Nakba and a photo of her brother-in-law's apartment building in Gaza after it had been struck by an Israeli regime airstrike. "Surely Instagram's guidelines cannot possibly be intended to prevent victims of violence and hate speech from sharing their experiences," El Borno said. Adding, "Every time I appealed Instagram's censorship of my post, Instagram would restore my post saying it never should have been deleted in the first place." El Borno explained that her posts were also subjected to shadow banning and had received frequent threats of deletion from Instagram. Despite none of her posts violating the company's guidelines, she also began losing hundreds of followers. El Borno provided several examples of social media repression to a Human Rights Watch report on the issue. On March 8, Instagram deleted the account for El Borno's podcast, The Palestine Pod. The platform initially provided no reason for the deletion, she said. Instagram even initially refused to review the deletion of the account due to El Borno's inability to provide company documents like articles of incorporation or a utility bill, documents which Instagram said they required in order to restore the account. "These documents do not exist," El Borno explained, "as the Palestinian Pod is a self-produced podcast show." Only after launching a social media campaign through the host's own individual accounts, as well as outreach on their behalf by the civil rights group Palestine Legal, was the account restored. El Borno and her co-host, Michael Scherzer, were informed by an email from Instagram's corporate office that the account was flagged for suspicious behavior either by scrapping information from Instagram, using an app or service to interact with Instagram in unauthorized ways, or because the account was shared or compromised. But again, none of the reasons were applicable to the podcast Instagram account activities. And once it was restored, El Borno and Scherzer received dozens of messages from fans who said they had been involuntarily kicked off of the account's followers list.
Free territory.
Part 2.
During my childhood, the conquest of desert was a dream that took me on a vacation to Patagonia. 200 kilometers on a straight line through the province of La Pampa.
Almost 150 years have passed since the Argentine Republic launched an offensive to expand its borders and dispose the indigenous people of their ancestral lands in the south part of the country. The conquest of the desert was not a trip. It was a campaign of extermination carried out by its two main protagonists, Julio Argentino Roca and Remington Rifles, who came from the United States. Julio Argentino Roca was a 35-year-old young general with a brilliant military career. In 1878, he was Minister of War and Navy. He was the intellectual and material author of the first genocide in the history of Argentina. While he was presenting his plans for the desert campaign to the assembly, he said, "We have 6,000 soldiers who are armed with the latest modern military inventions in order to fight against the 2,000 Indians who have no defense other than dispersion and no weapons other than the primitive spear." One of the most powerful indigenous chiefs of Patagonia was Modesto Encalao, a man who did not have a hostile policy towards the government of Argentina. He was deprived of his land, sent to prison, and later he was transferred to Buenos Aires. He was condemned to slavery in the last days of his life in the underground Museum of Natural Sciences of La Plata. Encalao was tormented and died far from his homeland. He spent long hours looking at the remains of his wife and loved ones that were exhibited by Perito Moreno as anthropological pieces in the museum. Those who saw him in the last days of his life described him as a ghost. The military soldiers had also stolen his children. Later, they gave the children to the families of the generals to work as their servants. Some reports point out that before his death, he ripped off the white man's clothes. Encalao had resisted declaring himself as Argentinian. His outraged body also remained as a museum piece for more than 100 years. At the beginning of the 21st century, many children from Patagonia wrote letters to the authorities of the La Plata Museum to ask them to return his remains to the original territory. Emmanuel Roman, a 10-year-old boy, wrote a letter, "I'm asking you to return the body parts of the aboriginals to their families. What they did to them were inhumane, removing the hair, brain, and body parts of Chief Encalao. I do not want the remains to be exhibited in a museum. He was a person like you and I. Sincerely yours." His body parts have been resting in Valladateca region since 2014, but I felt that he was still a prisoner. Other sources show that in reality their camps were not in that valley, but on the shores of Nahuel Huapi Lake. Encalao's portrait that is marked by the failure of people functions as a time machine that reminds indignation and impotence. I hope when he took his last breath in those torture halls in La Plata, he saw images of his territory, a free territory. Thank you. Today, the Mapuche people live on the fringe of the Patagonian cities and in hundreds of rural communities that record each particular reality. Since the conquest of desert, this indigenous ethnic group has struggled to recover the territories stolen by the state in Argentina, or Puel Mapu. As we know the original language, we understand that most of the complaints were made in the provinces of Nacuan, Rio Negro, and Chapat. Before the formation of the states at the beginning of the 19th century, these regions were inhabited by Mapuches, Tohuelches, and other small villages. The Nacuan community of Paisil Antirriao took the first steps to move towards understanding the problems of the land with its protagonists. In 1902, the Argentine state granted the possession of 625 hectares to Lunco Ignacio Antirriao on the banks of the Nahuel Huapi and Corrientoso lakes, where Villa La Angostura is currently located. Villa La Angostura is an exclusive tourist center where President Mauricio Macri usually goes there for his vacations. More than 100 years ago, the villa did not exist, and the Argentine state had to consolidate its sovereignty in the place, which is why they officially recognized the ownership of land to those who lived in the place ancestrally. A wooden statue reminds us of Lunco Antirriao, the person who helped the Argentinians during the border demarcation. By consolidating the villa as a touristic paradise, the state began to usurp territory until it occupied 500 out of the 625 of the community's hectares. In 2004, Emmanuel Ginobili, NBA world star, bought 11 hectares inside of community land. Rosa was living here until the millionaire player claimed for the seizure of the territory.
Ginobili fakes, lost it, gets it back, flips it up and flips it in! Exclamation point from Manu Ginobili!
The claim was rejected, but Rosa experienced several eviction attempts. In 1878, the president of Argentina, Nicolas Avellaneda, stated, "Our self-respect as a virile people obliges us to put down as soon as possible, by reason or by force, this handful of savages who destroy our wealth and prevent us from definitely occupying, in the name of law, progress, and our own security, the richest and most fertile lands of the Republic." Conflicts over lands acquire more dramatic cast in 39 kilometers south of Bariloche, the tourist epicenter of Patagonia. A Mapuche group from the suburbs of the city recovered a property that is claimed by national parks. In November 25, 2017, state security forces entered the territory and killed Rafael Noel. The government accused the young people of having used firearms and said that they belonged to RAM, the Mapuche Ancestral Resistance. It is considered as an organization that the executive relates it to guerrilla and terrorist activities. No firearms were seized during the operation. On August 1, 2017, another state operation killed Santiago Maldonado in a recovered territory in Cushman, Chubut province. The case seriously affected the image of the national government, as the young man's body remained missing for 78 days. Minister Bullrich belongs to an oligarchic family that benefited directly from the Desert Campaign. Likewise, Esteban Bullrich, who claimed the conquest as the Minister of Education. According to most accounts, Maldonado had entered the Chubut River with the intention of crossing it in an attempt to prevent the entrance of forces of repression. 5 days before the legislative elections, his body was found floating during a rake of the river. Cushaman's Polaf, in resistance, was recovered from the Benetton Company by a group that belongs to Lonco Facundo Jones Huala, syndicated as RAM leader. In January of that same year, his community had suffered a violent eviction attempt. Not all police officers hesitated to confront their ethnic contradictions. During the judicial hearings of Jones Huala's group, two agents are murmuring, and finally they recognize each other as Mapuche. But they affirm that these young people are an embarrassment and question their original membership. Benetton owns 900,000 hectares acquired in a transaction in 1991. During the previous 100 years, an English company registered in Argentina under the name Argentine Southern Land Company had the control of the land. In 1890, just after the end of the Desert Campaign, then-President Miguel Juarez Celman ceded those 900,000 hectares by decree as the Argentine state wished to populate Patagonia with white Europeans. The land was given away free of charge, without paying a single peso, just due to the commitment to bring in settlers and make investments. The vice president, Carlos Pellegrini, criticized this decision, and Juarez Celman replied in a letter that it was preferable to create an Ireland in Patagonia, to which it was submitted by the negligence of the Tehuelche. Juarez Celman was Roca's brother-in-law. Santiago Maldonado lost his life and disappeared after an action of state repression here in this area. There isn't a centralized government in the structure of Mapuche organization. In historical terms, this culture has given them a great power of military resistance. The Spanish conquistadors could vanish Mayas and Incas, but they couldn't do the same thing to the Mapuche nation, so they had to sign peace treaties recognizing the existence of this nation. As a counterpart, this worldview has prevented processes of broader unity. For centuries, different Mapuche camps have fought among themselves and did not come to an agreement for many times to confront the white man or Winca, but the conquistadors took the most advantage of this opportunity. The arrival of Spaniards, Argentinians, and Chileans unleashed a series of highly complex social and political processes within this original society. Today, you can easily see the divisions and the lack of a major force that could derive from a process of unity. The Mapuche world has been changed and the miscegenation has been advanced. Those who belittle indigenous people pretend to undermine the legitimacy of their claims under the argument of skin color. Fernando Nahuel Pan exemplifies the dichotomy between identity and miscegenation. Mauro Mihan recovered the territory that was in control of the police in the province of Chubut.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The limelight. In Britain, almost two-thirds of tenants over the age of 65 have cut back on their general spending as a result of the cost of living crisis, and campaigners are warning that older people who do not own their homes are particularly vulnerable to rising fuel bills. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnist Hilary Osborne. The piece is titled, Older UK Renters Forced to Cut Back on Spending as Living Costs Soar. In In Britain, almost two-thirds of tenants over the age of 65 have cut back on their general spending as a result of the cost of living crisis, and campaigners are warning that older people who do not own their homes are particularly vulnerable to rising electricity and fuel bills. Research shared with Guardian Money by the charity Independent Age puts the spotlight on the struggles of older tenants who are battling to keep up with rising household costs. Its survey found that 62% of renters over the age of 65 were having to cut back on their general spending, and that they were more likely to be doing so than their contemporaries who were homeowners. A quarter said they would not be able to afford a £10 a month increase in their living costs, while 71% said they would not be able to cover a £50 rise. More than half said they felt anxious about their finances. The state's pension increased by 3.1% last month, well below the 7% inflation rate recorded in March. Energy bills went up at the same time, and with a further increase likely this October, economists have predicted inflation could go above 10% before the end of the year. Older private renters are particularly vulnerable to soaring inflation, particularly where rents have been rising too, says Dan Wilson-Craw, the deputy director of the campaign group Generation Rent. Unlike homeowners who are likely to have paid off their mortgage, they still have housing costs. If landlords want to raise the rent to reflect the wider market, there is little current tenants can do. For retirees on fixed incomes, this cuts their disposable income or forces them to move. Independent Age's survey of 2,000 adults in England over the age of 65, of whom 391 were renting, found that 57% of tenants were cutting back on heating. 42% said they had reduced how much food and drink they were buying. And 29% were buying less vehicle fuel. Aside from those most essential purchases, 46% said that they had cut back on clothing and on footwear purchase, and 39% had reduced their social activities. Separate figures from Shelter show that between the financial years of 2020-2021 and 2021-2022, there was a 20% increase in the number of over 65s contacting its helpline who were at risk of homelessness. Francisca, a 64-year-old, and her husband Colin, a 70-year-old, say their rent has risen by more than 7% this year. They are struggling to cover it and the other bills they face, despite making cutbacks. "When we go to the supermarket, we are buying the cheapest of the cheap," she says. "We're taking fewer baths, fewer showers. We turn the lights off, even on cold days. We turn the heating off." Although the couple chose to rent because, says Francisca, "we're not sure what the future holds," she says it has left them vulnerable. They have lived in poor housing in the past while paying a high rent, were evicted through a Section 21 no-fault eviction by one previous landlord, and have also had problems with letting agencies. This has made them very nervous about what happens when their contract ends next March. Their age has financial implications. "At our stage of life, we have a pot of money, and if we live a long life, we have to stretch it over that time," she says. "We can't go to work 9 to 5 or get new careers, so we rely on freelancing." Morgan Vine, the Independent Age head of policy, says older renters are left in increasingly precarious financial situations and need help and protection from the government. "Our research found that older renters are one of the most at-risk groups of dropping into poverty past state pension age and are more likely to experience long-term poverty," she says. "Day to day, we also know older renters are at an increased risk of living in poor quality homes and face higher costs and greater financial insecurity than other groups as a result." Morgan Vine says older renters have shared concerns with the charity about high rents and that their landlords could sell up at any time. With a cost of living crisis squeezing people's budgets from every angle, these worries are only going to get worse, she says. Renters make up the minority of households in England, with a head aged 65 or over, according to the latest official figures. The latest data shows there are 5.5 million owner-occupiers in this age range and 5.1 million own their home outright, which means no monthly mortgage costs. There are only 382,000 households in the private sector headed by an older person and 1 million in the social rented sector. Housing associations are allowed to put up rents by 4.1% in April, and many tenants who rent from them have seen increases. In the private rented sector, it is not easy to see what is happening to existing tenancies, but newly advertised contracts are typically costing more than a year ago. Polly Neat, the chief executive of Shelter, says older tenants are likely to be on low incomes, which would mean pressure from rising costs. With bills skyrocketing and private rents the highest on record, it's no wonder our emergency helpline is picking up the phone to older renters who, instead of preparing for retirement, are facing homelessness. No one should be forced to choose between eating or paying their rent, she says. Wilson Crawl says the state pension has risen by less than inflation, but it's worse for private renters relying on housing benefit, which has been frozen since 2020. If these people are paying higher rents, that money could be coming out of the rest of their income, and that's before we even think about rising energy prices. Wilson Crow adds, we need a freeze on rents and another suspension of evictions to protect tenants during this crisis.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
The British government has been accused of trading people like commodities after Prime Minister Boris Johnson announced last month that the migrants and asylum seekers illegally entering Britain will be sent thousands of miles away to Rwanda as part of a deal with the African country.
From today, our new migration and economic development partnership will mean that anyone entering the UK illegally, as well as those who have arrived illegally since January the 1st, may now be relocated to Rwanda.
Welcome, and this is Africa Today, a weekly program that gives you an alternative view of events making headlines in Africa. This week, we are focusing on Britain's controversial plans to deport asylum seekers to Rwanda. Now, human rights activists are saying that this deal is cruel, immoral, neo-colonial, likely unlawful, and a threat to the lives of refugees. So what are the real reasons behind this deal, and is London imitating a similar arrangement that the Israeli regime had with Rwanda? Is this agreement part of a plan by Boris Johnson to divert attention from the embarrassment of his Partygate scandal? These are some of the questions which I'll be asking our experts today.
Inhuman UK-Rwanda Refugee Pact. The United Kingdom is under harsh criticism over its plan to send illegal immigrants and asylum seekers thousands of miles away to Rwanda.
Last month, Britain announced a deal with Rwanda to send asylum seekers to the East African country, claiming the measure would stop people smugglers sending desperate migrants on treacherous journeys across the English Channel. Prime Minister Boris Johnson claims that Rwanda will have the capacity to resettle tens of thousands of people in the years ahead.
The UK has promised Rwanda an initial £120 million as part of what has been termed as an economic transformation and integration program. Now, this payment has been equated to a slave trade agreement. Rwandan opposition leader Frank Habineza has slammed Britain's decision to send refugees to his country, terming it as inhumane and a violation of human rights.
We are competing against these kind of deals, whether it's Denmark or UK or Israel or whatever. We are not in agreement. If people come to you, take care of them. We have signed the UN Convention, all of us, to take care of refugees. It's really inhumane and also against human rights. Because if it's the right of the people to go where they have gone. So if you send them to a country where they do not choose, that means you're forcing them to go somewhere elsewhere. So that's against their rights. It's an abuse of human rights as well. So we have to respect their rights and the rights of refugees.
For more on this controversial Rwanda-UK refugee deal, we contacted Claude Gatebuke, the executive director of the Africa Great Lakes Action Network. Thanks a lot, sir, for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
We also have with us today Julius Mbaluto, an African affairs analyst, who will also briefly contribute to our conversation. Welcome again to our program, Mr. Mbaluto.
My pleasure.
Now, human rights groups and refugee organizations have called Britain's plan to send refugees to Rwanda as cruel, inhumane, and neocolonial. Mr. Gatebuke, do you agree with this description?
Absolutely. The only thing I would add is a few other things. It's not only cruel, inhumane, and neo-colonialist, it's also human trafficking. It is the trade of humans in selling people to, you know, trading people for money. It's similar to the slave trade. It's basically modern-day slave trade. And by the way, this is just a legalized way of trafficking human beings. So that would be my one additional remark to that. So calling it cruel, inhumane, and neocolonial is true. It also, there is just a stench of white supremacy, where you think people that you do not desire or individuals that you do not desire, that you could just take them and dump them, basically throw them away and just pay the money to throw them away and send them to an African country.
Rwanda is a country that has experienced deadly ethnic and political tensions and produces many refugees itself. This tiny and densely populated country suffered a devastating genocide in 1994, where more than 800,000, mostly ethnic Tutsis, were massacred. Opposition leader Frank Habineza warns that the influx of new refugees could be dangerous for the country.
Conflicts are inevitable. When people come in and you say you're going to give them those £120 million and they are going to live a very good life, whereas other Rwandans, they don't have anything the same way as that, then be sure that there will be conflicts that people will say, oh, so these people are living a better life than us. Yeah, so there'll be conflicts. Then there'll also be conflicts on natural resources, competition. We don't have land, and if the Americans are going to settle here, that means we'll be given land. They'll be also put into the national budget like others, because that money is only for 5 years. Afterwards, we don't know what happens.
Why did Britain decide to select Rwanda, one of the most densely populated countries in the world and one of the tiniest countries in Africa?
There is not even the space for the people there, but Britain and Rwanda both have a lot to gain from each other. Rwanda will gain PR, which it's badly in need of because of the way they treat their abysmal and horrible human rights record. And the British get to play the card that will please Prime Minister Boris Johnson's constituents. I'm not sure that they all even like that idea. I think they just thought if we dump immigrants and turn the issue to the immigrants, everything will be fine. Everything is about money. you know, Britain is going to gain, politically, especially the party in power, and Rwanda is going to gain money. But the people who are being dumped to Rwanda are going to suffer, like other refugees who have been sent, who have sought refuge in Rwanda.
The UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR, also voiced opposition to the UK-Rwanda refugee deal. Assistant High Commissioner for Protection, Gillian Trick, says people fleeing war, conflict, and persecution deserve compassion and empathy. They should not be treated like commodities and transferred abroad for processing.
Triggs described the Rwanda-US deal as shifting asylum responsibilities and evading international obligations that are contrary to the letter and spirit of the Refugee Convention. Now, let's bring in Mr. Mbaluto. What's your take on Britain's decision to literally dump refugees into Rwanda?
When you look into the UK, their position is like they want to exploit freedoms that came because of Brexit. But if you know what was the driving force with the Brexit, was extreme racism, and it was really not really such a great thing. In UK leaving Europe was not driven because of good reasons, but more than, you know, wanting to be independent, make decisions, not be controlled by European Court of Law, which was all the time reinforcing human rights when they were being violated within the UK territory.
Well, now, despite some positive economic indicators, Rwanda is still among the world's 25 poorest countries. Now, Britain's use of cash to entice Rwanda to accept the deal is considered as some form of exploitation.
Britain claims to be a champion of human rights, but it breaches its international commitments and responsibilities by sending refugees to Rwanda.
If you'd only listen to the claims by these nations, you know, claiming to be, to respect human rights, you might believe it. But when you look at some of the practices in Britain, when it comes to immigrants and refugees, I mean, in recent years, there were refugee and immigrant protest, you know, showing that, you know, their rights were not highly respected. But if you look at human rights, you can't just confine yourself to inside of the country and to claim the person, the country that simply claims to be a champion for human rights.
Britain's opposition leader has also slammed the government's plan to send illegal immigrants to Rwanda to have their claims processed. Let's listen in.
I think we need to see these plans for what they are. It's a desperate announcement by a Prime Minister who just wants to distract from his own law-breaking. You know, they're unworkable, they're extortionate, they're going to cost taxpayers billions of pounds, and they just reflect a Prime Minister who's got no grit, no answers to the questions that need answering, and no shame. And I just think Britain deserves better than this. I think it's a desperate announcement. The true aim of this is just to distract from the law-breaking of the Prime Minister. And that's why I say it shows that he's got no answers, he's got no grip, he's got no shame. It's a desperate announcement, unworkable, extortionate, and Britain really does deserve better than this.
Boris Johnson's Rwanda migrant announcement has been termed as an attempt to divert attention from the Partygate scandal. What's your take on this, Mr. Mbaluto?
When you look into all these scandals surrounding the Prime Minister and all the criticism, you know, all the attention that drew, you may wonder whether it was a move to kill bad news. Bad news, I'm talking about the scandals, the Partygate scandal, COVID, handling of the COVID, and everything that was all around it. Of course, we see still ongoing, but he refused to resign. He apologized. He was fined by the police only £50.
Okay, we thank Mr. Mbaluto for his insight, and we now take a short break. When we come back, we shall continue with our discussion on the controversial plan by Britain to forcefully send asylum seekers to Rwanda. So stay with us.
Mm-hmm. Inhuman UK-Rwanda Refugee Pact.
You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
Welcome back to this week's edition of Africa Today, which is focusing on an inhumane Rwanda-UK deal on refugees. Now, the Israeli regime also struck secret deals in 2013 with Rwanda and Uganda to transfer asylum seekers from Sudan and Eritrea. Rwanda's last migrant deal with the Israeli regime ended in disaster. Now, can you elaborate on the fate of the refugees dumped by the Israeli regime into Rwanda?
There are the Eritreans and the Sudanese refugees who were part of a deal with Israel. And I know we may be talking about this a little bit later, but I want to, you know, just put it all together. There's a group of refugees from Israel. They were Eritrean and Sudanese. There was a plan to send to Rwanda 4,000 refugees, $5,000 a head. So they were selling them, basically. You know, Rwanda was doing the trade with Israel to trade the refugees. Rwanda was going to make $20 million off of the deal. They started with a pilot. The initial refugees, the Eritrean refugees that they sent to Rwanda, were distorted of their money by Rwandan officials who were supposed to resettle them in Rwanda. They took their money. They put them in horrible living conditions. They raped the women. And they impregnated children. Some of those refugees were dumped at the border of Uganda after they took away all their papers and everything. Those refugees ended up in Libya in slavery. And some of them have made their way all the way back to Europe. So it hasn't worked even previously when it was done. That deal ended up falling apart.
The then Prime Minister of the Israeli regime, Benjamin Netanyahu, pursued the inhumane deal to forcefully deport African refugees in an attempt to please his supporters in Israel. To capitalize on the xenophobia and anti-African sentiments he has encouraged when he came to power in 2009. Is Boris Johnson taking cue from Netanyahu by sending refugees to Rwanda to deflect attention from the Partygate scandal?
It's always the easy escape when it comes, as I said before, to white supremacy. White supremacy basically looks at black and brown people, non-white people, as objects. And the Boris Johnson government facing Partygate found the objects that they could basically dump, where they could deflect the attention. And the deflection of attention went to the immigrants and the black and brown people, basically, for the most part. So it's similar game. It's a similar play. It's same playbook when it comes to when these Western leaders are in trouble, they turn to racism, xenophobia, and white supremacy. And that is what happened with the Boris Johnson government trying to deal with Partygate.
The controversial arrangement between Rwanda and the Israeli regime on the deportation of asylum seekers failed when the refugees who had their documents taken away and were offered no protection escaped Rwanda to embark on a dangerous journey to Europe. an African immigrant in the occupied territories, voiced his opposition to the deportation deals.
אני רואה את המצב עכשיו מאוד מאוד קשה, מאוד גרוע. אנחנו שכר בן אדם. איך יכול להיות? אני לא מיוגנדה, אני לא מרואנדה. איך יכול להיות ראש הממשלה מחליט אנשים לשחוק אותם למדינות אחרים? ובלי שום אישור, בלי מסמכים, בלי שום דבר. איך אפשר למכור אותנו כאילו אנחנו עבדים? מה אנחנו? איך? איך זה יכול להיות? אחרי 10 שנים.